This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to our program. We're reading from Ernest Gaines' novel, A Lesson Before Dying. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and will be made available in podcast after the broadcast. We're pleased to present these dramatic readings of A Lesson Before Dying using a cast of volunteer readers. Feel free to call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138.
We followed him down a long, dark corridor, passing offices with open doors and bathrooms for white ladies and white men. At the end of the corridor, we had to go up a set of stairs. The stairs were made of steel. There were 6 steps, then a landing, a sharp turn, and another 6 steps. Then we went through a heavy steel door to the area where the prisoners were quartered. The white prisoners were also on this floor, but in a separate section. I counted 8 cells for black prisoners, with 2 bunks of each cell. Half of the cells were empty. The others had 1 or 2 prisoners. They reached their hands out between the bars and asked for cigarettes or money. Miss Emma stopped to talk to them. She told them she didn't have any money, but she had brought some food for Jefferson, and if there was anything left, she would give it to them. They asked me for money, and I gave them the change I had. There was an empty cell between Jefferson and the rest of the prisoners. He was at the end of the cell block. He was lying on his bunk when we came in. The deputy unlocked the door for us, and Miss Emma and I went in. The deputy told us that he would have to lock us in and that he would return within an hour. Miss Emma thanked him, and he locked the door and left. Jefferson still lay on his bunk, staring up at the ceiling. He didn't look at us once. "How you feel, Jefferson?" Miss Emma asked him. He didn't answer. He kept his eyes on the ceiling. The cell was roughly 6 by 10, with a metal bunk covered by a thin mattress and a woolen army blanket. Toilet without cedar paper. Washbowl, brownish from residue and grime. Small metal shelf upon which was a pan, a tin cup, and a tablespoon. Single light bulb hung over the center of the cell, and at the end opposite the door was a barred window, which looked out onto a sycamore tree behind the courthouse. I could see the sunlight on the upper leaves, but the window was too high to catch sight of any other buildings or the ground. "I come to see you and brung you something," Miss Emma said. We were standing because there was no place to sit. "You been all right?" she asked him. He lay there looking up at the ceiling. His hair had grown out since the trial, but I'm sure he had not combed it once. I told myself that I would bring him a comb next time I came. "I brought Professor Wiggins," Miss Emma said. "I brought you some fried chicken, some good old yams, and I brought you some tea cakes, too." He looked up at the ceiling. "Ain't you going to ask me to sit down, Jefferson?" He looked up at the ceiling, but he wasn't seeing the ceiling. Miss Emma put the handbag of clothes and the basket of food on the floor, sat down on the bunk beside him. I should say that she sat as much of herself on the bunk as she could. About half, I would say. She passed her hand over his forehead and over his hair. "Ain't you going to speak to me, Jefferson?" she asked. He remained quiet. She stroked his hair again. "You want to talk just to me? You want Professor Wiggins to leave?" He didn't answer. "You want me to go and you just talk to Professor Wiggins?" He still didn't answer. She looked up at me. She was ready to cry, and I wished I was somewhere else. "Hand me that basket, Grant," she said. I passed her the basket. She took out a piece of chicken wrapped in brown paper. She unwrapped the drumstick and held it before Jefferson. "Look what I brought you," she said. "I knowed how much you like my fried chicken. Brought you some yams and some tea cakes, too. Ain't you gonna try some of it?" "Don't matter," I heard him say. He was looking up at the ceiling. "What don't matter?" He didn't answer. "What don't matter, Jefferson?" "Nothing don't matter," he said, looking up at the ceiling, but not seeing the ceiling. "It mattered to me, Jefferson," she said. "You matter to me." He looked up at the ceiling, not seeing it. "Jefferson?" "Chicken, dirt, don't matter," he said. "Yeah, do, Jefferson. Yeah, do, dirt." "All the same," he said, "don't matter." "My chicken?" she said. "I'm tasting it right now." She took a small bite. "You always like my chicken every Sunday." He was quiet. "You like a yam?" she asked him. He didn't answer her. "You want a tea cake? You don't have to eat no chicken if you don't want. You don't have to eat no yam neither, but I know how much you like my tea cakes. I didn't bring no clabber, but Jefferson." "When they gonna do it?" "Tomorrow." "Do what, Jefferson?" He was quiet, looking up at the ceiling, but not seeing it. "What, Jefferson?" He turned toward her. The body didn't turn, just his head turned a little. His eyes did most of the turning. He looked at her as though he did not know who she was or what she was doing there. Then he looked at me. "You know what I'm talking about, don't you?" his eyes said. They were big brown eyes, the whites too reddish. "You know, don't you?" his eyes said again. I looked back at him. My eyes would not dare answer him. But his eyes knew that my eyes knew. "You with him?" he asked me. "With who?" I said. His eyes mocked me. They were big brown eyes, and the whites were too reddish, and he had been thinking too much the past few weeks, and the eyes mocked me. "You won?" he asked me. "The one for what?" I said. His big brown eyes with reddish whites mocked me. "Go and eject that switch," he said to me. "What switch?" Miss Emma said. He was looking at me, not at her. His eyes told me that I knew what switch he was talking about. "That's Professor Wiggins, your teacher. What switch?" she asked. He turned his head and began staring up at the ceiling again. The deputy came back and stood just outside the cell. Miss Emma still sat on the bunk, but now Jefferson had turned his back to her and was facing the gray concrete wall. Miss Emma passed her hand over his hair again, then she pushed herself up from the bunk. "I'm leaving, Jefferson," she said. "I'll come back soon." The deputy opened the door to the cell, let us out. "Can I leave the food?" Miss Emma asked him. "Sure," the deputy said. "If he don't eat it all, can you give it to the rest of them children?" "Sure," the deputy said. He locked the cell door. "I'm leaving, Jefferson," Miss Emma said, looking back into the cell. He faced the gray concrete wall and didn't answer. "Oh, Lord Jesus," she cried. "Oh, Lord Jesus, stand by, stand by." The deputy and I exchanged glances. With his eyes and a nod, he told me to put my arms around her, which I did.
Chapter 10. Our next two visits went pretty much as the first one did. I picked up Miss Emma at her house around 1:30. My aunt was always there with her. and after she had settled down in the back seat of the car, we drove in silence all the way to Bayonne. Each time we arrived 5 or 10 minutes before the hour, the food was searched, and I was asked to take everything out of my pockets, then told to put everything back in my pockets, and we were led down the narrow, dark wood corridor, passing open office doors where white men and white women carried on their daily routines. The deputy walked a step ahead of us, with Miss Emma directly behind him and me beside her. At the end of the corridor, we would climb the steps to the first landing, where the deputy would wait a minute to allow Miss Emma to catch her breath. Then we would continue on up to the next floor and through the heavy steel door to the cell block. The prisoners would hear us coming, and they would stand at the cell doors with their hands stuck out between the bars. As she had done the first time, Miss Emma promised them that they could have the food that Jefferson did not eat. As I had done the first time, I gave them the change I had in my pockets, which was always less than a dollar. Then we would move down the line to the last cell. Jefferson always lay on the bunk, either looking at the ceiling or facing the wall. Each time, the deputy opened the door and locked us in. Jefferson had no more talk about the second or third time than he did the first, and after we spent an hour with him, we were let out. And each time, Miss Emma left the cell crying, and both times she told the young deputy to give the food to the other children. On Friday, our fourth visit, I left Irene Cole in charge of the school and instructed her to let the children go at 3. If she felt they had done all their schoolwork before 3, she could dismiss them early, because it was getting colder and most of the children would have work to do at home. I had to go down to my aunt's house to get my car, then drove back up to the corridor to Miss Emma's. Usually she was waiting for me, but not today. I sat out there in the car for a good 5 minutes, but no Miss Emma. I didn't want to blow the horn. I thought that might show impatience and disrespect. Still no Miss Emma. The door was shut, and the only thing to give the place any sign of life was a trickle of white smoke rising occasionally out of the chimney. After sitting there another couple of minutes, I put patience and respect aside. I pressed on the horn long and hard, enough for everybody in the quarter to hear it. I had given up my class to take her to Bayonne, and she was not ready, and I wanted them all to know about it. Finally, the door did open. My aunt came out on the porch and pushed the door shut behind her. She stood there watching me. I knew that stand. I knew that look. I knew that she was not coming one step farther and that I would have to come to her. She still watched me as I got out of the car and came up the walk. I stopped short of the porch. "Something wrong with you?" she asked me. I wanted to ask that same question about Miss Emma, but I held my tongue. "Don't you know if she was able, she would be out here? Then why didn't she tell me she wasn't going? I could be teaching my class." "Nobody said you wasn't going." "You're saying I'm supposed to visit him alone. He's no kin. Come on in here, boy, and get that bag," my aunt said. She watched me come up the porch and go by her. Then she followed me into the house. Miss Emma was sitting at the fireplace in a rocking chair. She had on 2 sweaters, a black one over a green one. She had some kind of rag, possibly a diaper, tied around her head. I stood in the center of the room, near the hanging light bulb. I had the feeling Miss Emma was not nearly as sick as she was pretending to be. For one thing, I had seen her that morning picking up chips in the yard, and she didn't look sick at all. And now I could smell fried chicken and baked potato, and I knew she could not have done all of that if she was dying. My aunt sat down in the rocker next to Miss Emma's. Now both of them peered into the fireplace at the 2 half-burned logs that gave about as much fire as a candle would. Neither said a thing, as if they were sitting alone in deep thought. Then Miss Emma coughed twice, short and dry, to let me know that she was on her deathbed. Then silence again. There was smoke in the room, and I must have cleared my throat or something because my aunt used that moment to speak. "That food waitin'." I didn't know where the food was waiting for me. I didn't look for it. I just stood back looking at them. "He don't have to go," Miss Emma said. She coughed again, reminding me that she was still on her deathbed. "Not if going's being a burden." My aunt looked back at me. "I said that food waitin'." "Miss Emma's dying, but you can go with me," I said. "I don't have on my good dress," my aunt said. "I can wait," I said. "No, you won't," she said. "Don't force him," Miss Emma said. "When I am able to get on my feet, God willing, I'll get somebody else to take me up there. I don't want to be a burden on nobody." As I stood there listening to her, I realized that this had been planned from the beginning. All that other stuff I went through was just to lead up to this day. Going up to Pichot's house, meeting the sheriff, the 3 visits to the jail with her. All that was nothing but preparation for today. Didn't she say it that first night at Pichot's? I'm old. My heart won't take it. I want somebody else to take my place. Didn't she say it? Sure she did, because it was planned even then. But she had had help. My aunt. She coughed again, quick, dry, faked, as before. I told myself that what she needed was more wood on the fire. I went to the corner of the room where the wood was stacked, and I piled as many logs on my arms as I could stand up with. Then I threw them all in the fireplace. Sparks of fire shot across the hearth into the room, and smoke and ashes shot up the chimney. I brushed off my clothes and stood there until the wood had started burning. "Can I do anything else, Miss Emma?" I said. "Maybe some cough syrup." "You can watch your tongue, sir," my aunt said. "I just want Miss Emma to get better," I said. "He don't have to go," Miss Emma said. "He's going," my aunt said. "If it's a burden," Miss Emma said. "Maybe I'll go halfway," I said. "Maybe I'll dump the food out there in the river. Fishes don't get much to eat in winter. Maybe they like fried chicken." "You better get that food and get out of here if you know what's good for you," my aunt said. I went back into the kitchen, snatched the bag off the table. There was enough food in it to feed everybody in the jail. "Everything you sent me to school for, you are stripping me of it," I told my aunt. They were looking at the fire, and I stood behind them with that bag of food. The humiliation I had to go through going into that man's kitchen. The hours I had to wait while they ate and drank and socialized before they would even see me. Now going up to that jail, to watch them put their dirty hands on that food, to search my body each time as if I'm some kind of common animal. Maybe today they'll want to look into my mouth, or my nostrils, or make me strip. Anything to humiliate me. All the things you wanted me to escape by going to school. Years ago, Professor Antoine told me that if I stayed here, they were going to break me down to the nigger I was born to be. But he didn't tell me that my aunt would help them do it. She got up slowly, heavily, and went to Miss Emma, who had begun to shake her head and cry. Miss Emma sincerely did not want me to go now, but my aunt had not changed her mind for a moment. "I'm sorry, Mr. Grant. I'm helping them white people to humiliate you. I'm so sorry. And I wished they had somebody else we could turn to. But they ain't nobody else."
Chapter 11. The sheriff was in his office when I came into the courthouse. I could see him behind his desk, talking to another man who had just opened the door to leave. They talked a while longer. Then the man came out into the corridor. I caught the door and went into the office with the bag of food. "Help you?" Guidry asked me. He sat with his cowboy boots propped up on the desk. He wore an open-collar light gray shirt and dark gray pants. His necktie, his cowboy hat, and his coat hung on a rack by the file cabinet next to his desk. This was the first time he'd been in his office since I started coming up here, but I didn't doubt that he knew who I was. "I came to see Jefferson," I said. "How y'all getting along? This'll be my first time alone with him." "What's in the basket?" "Food his Nan and sent him." "Paul?" Guidry called while still looking at me. The young deputy came into the office from a side door. "Called, Sheriff?" Guidry nodded toward me. "How you doing?" the deputy asked. "Fine. And yourself?" "I can't complain," he said. We went through the usual routine. I had to take everything out of my pockets and put it all back. The deputy went through all the food, unwrapping one piece of chicken, checking it, putting it back. He unwrapped two or three pieces of candy, checked out the bag of sweet potatoes, then, finished, he wiped his hands on a pocket handkerchief. "Still think you can get something into that head of his?" Guidry spoke across the tips of those cowboy boots. "I don't know, sir." "Just remember what I said," Guidry said. "Any sign of aggravation, I'll stop all this." I nodded my head. Then I remembered that I had to speak out. "Yes, sir." He looked at me a while. Then he nodded to the deputy and we left the office. Since Miss Emma was not with us this time, I walked beside the deputy instead of behind him. We went by all the familiar open doors where people pecked on typewriters. We climbed the familiar stairs up to the big steel door that led onto the cell block. By now, I could probably have done this with my eyes shut. The prisoners came to the cell doors as before. If they were not the same ones, they were the same ages, in their late teens or early 20s. I gave them the change I had. Nobody got more than a dime. Two could put their money together and get a pack of cigarettes, or one could get a pack of gum and a candy bar. Jefferson sat on his bunk with his head bowed and his arms hanging down between his legs. The deputy opened the door for me to go in, and he reminded me that he would be back within the hour. In case I wanted to leave before then, I could call a trustee, and the trustee would come to get him. "Jefferson," I said. He didn't look up. "Your Nanon couldn't make it today," I said. "She has a bad cold, but she sent you something. How are you feeling, Jefferson?" After a while, he raised his head, but he didn't look at me. He looked at the barred window. From the cell, all you could see were the yellow leaves on the sycamore tree and the pale blue sky between the leaves. "You hungry?" I asked. "You brought some corn?" he said. "Corn? That's what hogs eat," he said, turning his head now to look at me. He had not washed his face or combed his hair for days. He wore one of my old khaki shirts with a wrinkled pair of brown pants. He didn't have on shoes. They were stuck under the bunk. "I didn't bring any corn," I said, "and you're not a hog." He looked at me as if I was patronizing him. "When was the last time you ate?" I asked him. "I don't know." "Today?" I asked him. "I don't know." He was playing with me, and I knew it. "Some chicken in there," I said. "Biscuits and sweet potatoes, even some candy she made. You ought to try it. It'll make her happy." "Hogs don't eat no candy," he said. "You're not a hog," I said. "You're a man." He grunted deep in his throat and grinned at me. "Mind if I have a piece of your chicken?" I asked him. "I left before dinner." He acted as though he had not heard me. Since the deputy had already gone through the paper bag, I didn't have to do too much unwrapping to get to the food. I took out a drumstick and a biscuit and started eating. "Your Nanon sure can cook," I said. "That's for humans," he said. "You're a human being, Jefferson," I said. "I'm old hog," he said. "Humans don't stay in no stall like this. I'm old hog they fatten up to kill." "That would hurt your Nanon if she heard you say that. You want me to tell her you said that?"
"Old hog don't care what people say."
"She cares," I said. "And I do too, Jefferson."
"Y'all humans," he said.
"You're a human being too, Jefferson."
"I'm old hog," he said, more to himself than to me. "Just old hog they fatten up to kill for Christmas."
"You're a human being, Jefferson. You're a man." He kept his eyes on me as he got up from the bunk.
"I gonna show you how old hog eat," he said.
He knelt down on the floor and put his head inside the bag and started eating without using his hands. He even sounded like a hog. I stood back watching him while I continued to eat the biscuit and piece of chicken.
"That's how old hog eat," he said, raising his head and grinning at me.
He got up from his knees and went back to his bunk.
"That's how old hog eat."
"All right," I said. "But when I go back, I'm going to tell her that you and I sat on the bunk and ate, and you said how good the food was. I won't tell her what you did. She's already sick, and that would kill her. So I'm going to lie. I'm going to tell her how much you like the food, especially the pralines." He said nothing. He just grinned at me. "Are you trying to hurt me, Jefferson?" I asked him. "Are you trying to make me feel guilty for your being here? You don't want me to come back here anymore?" His expression didn't change, as though someone had chiseled that painful, cynical grin on his face. "That man out there doesn't want me up here either," I told him. "He said I will never be able to make you understand anything. He said I'm just wasting my time coming up here now. But your Nanon doesn't think so. She wants me to come up here. She wants us to talk." "What do you want? You want me to stay away and let him win, the white man? You want him to win?" His expression remained the same, cynical, defiant, painful. I could not think of anything else to say to him. but since I had been there less than half an hour, I knew it was too early to call for the deputy. The sheriff would have known that Jefferson and I were not getting along, and that was the last thing I could afford, at least for Miss Emma's sake. The rest of the hour just dragged along. Jefferson was not looking at me anymore. He'd lain back down on the bunk, facing the wall. I gazed out the window, at the yellow leaves on the sycamore tree. The leaves were as still as if they were painted there. Between the leaves, I could see bits of pale blue sky. I looked at Jefferson with his back to me. I looked at his pair of laceless shoes under the bunk. I looked down at the bag of food, trying to remember how many pieces of chicken, biscuits, potatoes, or pieces of candy were still in there. I went to the wash bowl and got a handful of water to drink. I tried turning the faucet off completely, but it continued to drip. The water had left a brown stain from the top of the bowl to the drain. I turned to Jefferson again. He was facing the wall, his back to me. I wanted to ask him what he was thinking about. When I heard the deputy come down the cell block, I went to the bunk. "Anything you want me to tell your nanin?" I asked him. He didn't answer. His eyes were open and staring at the wall. "I'll tell her how much you enjoyed the food," I said. "That would make her happy." The deputy came up to the cell and let me out. "Y'all doing all right?" he asked as we walked away. "He was glad to get some home cooking," I said. "I can't blame him for that," the deputy said.
Chapter 12. I knew Miss Emma expected me to come back and tell her all about Jefferson, but I had not thought of a good lie yet. I couldn't go there and tell her what had really happened. That would have hurt too much. I couldn't go there and say that we had had a good talk. She probably wouldn't have believed it, not after the way he had acted when we were there together. I needed time to think of something. Not a big lie, just a little lie or a number of little lies, but a lie it had to be. Maybe I could tell her that he was concerned about her health. She would like that. Maybe I could tell her he had begun to use the brush and comb I had brought for him. Or maybe I could say that the deputy had told me what a good prisoner he was and that the sheriff himself had said he was a good boy. I needed time. Time to get my lies straight. And the best place for that was at the Rainbow. I got into my car and drove back of town. The Rainbow Club was quiet, dark and quiet. There were only two old men in the place, besides Joe Claiborne, who was behind the bar. All three stood talking baseball. Jackie Robinson. Robinson had just finished his second year with the Brooklyn Dodgers. "What's happening, Prof?" Claiborne said to me. "Jack's," I said. He brought the bottle of beer to me. "A little business in town," I said. Claiborne could see that I didn't want to talk about the business, or maybe he realized what the business was. He nodded his head and went back down the bar where the other customers were. The two old men had continued their conversation, and Claiborne joined them again as if he had never left. From where I stood, about halfway down the bar, all I could hear was Jackie this and Jackie that. Nothing about any of the other players, nothing about the Brooklyn Dodgers as a team, only Jackie. Jackie this and Jackie that. I sipped my beer slowly while listening to them, and they were very good. They could recall everything Jackie had done in the past 2 years. They remembered when he got his first hit and who it was against. They remembered the first time he stole two bases in one game and the first time he stole home. One of the men backed away from the bar to demonstrate how slow the pitcher was in throwing the ball, which gave Jackie the opportunity to steal home plate. The old man looked over each shoulder, as pitchers do when there are runners on bases. He raised his leg as high as he could, which was only about a foot off the floor, to show how much time the pitcher took to throw the ball to the plate. While the pitcher went through the motion of raising his leg and winding his arm, Jackie was on his way home. Now the old man became Jackie, not running, but showing the motion of someone running at full speed. His arms were doing what the legs could not do. He showed you the motion of Jackie sliding into the plate, the motion of the umpire calling Jackie safe, and the motion of Jackie brushing off his clothes and going into the dugout. The old man nodded his head emphatically with great pride and went back to the bar. Claiborne and the other old man told him that he was exactly right. Listening to them, I could remember back to the time before Jackie came to the major leagues, when it was Joe Louis that everyone talked about. Yes, I could remember. I could remember when he was the only one. Especially the big fight with Schmeling, that German. I could still remember how depressed everyone was after Joe had lost the first fight with Schmeling. For weeks it was like that. To be caught laughing for any reason seemed like a sin. This was a period of mourning. What else in the world was there to be proud of if Joe had lost? Even the preacher got into it. Let us wait. Let us wait, children. David will meet Goliath again. And everyone told everyone else, they'd gone meet again. Just wait. And we waited and waited. And finally the big fight did come. There were two radios in the quarter, one at the Williams house down the quarter, another at the McVeighs up the quarter. I was down the quarter. I was 17 then. I was not the youngest, nor surely the oldest. I was just one, praying and hoping for the only hero we knew. There was much noise, much talking, while the people waited for the fight to begin. Once the announcer said the fighters were in the ring, everyone became silent without anybody having to tell them to do so. There were small children there, too, but even they had quit playing and were silent. We held our breath, remembering the first fight. Could God let it happen again? Would He let it happen again? Then it was over. And there was nothing but chaos. People screamed. Some shot pistols in the air. There were mock fights. Old men fell down on the floor, as Schmeling did, and had to be helped up. Everybody laughed. Everybody patted everybody else on the back. For days after the fight, for weeks, we held our heads higher than any people on earth had ever done for any reason. I was only 17 then, but I could remember it, every bit of it, the warm evening, the people, the noise, the pride I saw in those faces. Now, while I stood there listening to the old men in their praise of Jackie Robinson, I remembered something else. The little Irishman. I was at the university then. The little Irishman was giving a series of lectures at white universities, but some way or another, our university got him to visit us. How? Only God knows. But we were all gathered in the auditorium, and there stood this little white man with a thick accent talking to us about Irish literature. He spoke of Yeats, O'Casey, Joyce, names I had never heard before. I sat there listening, trying to remember everything he said, and a name he repeated over and over was Parnell. And he told us how some Irishmen would weep this day at the mention of the name Parnell. Parnell, Parnell, Parnell. Then he spoke of James Joyce. He told about Joyce's family, his religion, his education, his writing. He spoke of a book called Dubliners and a story in the book titled Ivy Day in the Committee Room. Regardless of race, regardless of class, that story was universal, he said. For days after the lecture, I tried to find that book. But it was not in our library, and not in any of the bookstores. I went to Mr. Anderson, my literature teacher, and asked him if he knew how I could get a copy. He said he would see what he could do. A week later, he kept me after class and handed me a collection of stories. It was not Joyce's Dubliners, but an anthology of short stories, with Ivy Day in the Committee Room included as one of them. Mr. Anderson had gotten a professor at the White University to check the book out of his library for him. "He's a pretty decent fellow," Mr. Anderson said about the white professor. "Some of them are, you know, and always remember that. Now take care of that book. You can keep it a week, and it had better come back to me in the same condition in which it left. Do you understand me?" "You do, don't you, Wiggins?" I read this story and reread this story, but I still could not find the universality that the little Irishman had spoken of. All I saw in the story was some Irishmen meeting in a room and talking politics. What had that to do with America, especially with my people? It was not until years later that I saw what he meant. I had gone to bars, to barber shops. I had stood on street corners, and I had gone to many suppers there in the quarter. But I had never really listened to what was being said. Then I began to listen. To listen closely to how they talked about their heroes. How they talked about the dead and about how great the dead had once been. I heard it everywhere. The old men down at the end of the bar were still talking about Jackie Robinson, but I was not thinking about Jackie now, or Joe Lewis, or that little Irishman. I was thinking about that cold, depressing cell uptown. I raised my hand for Claiborne to bring me another beer. He gave me the bottle and looked into my eyes, and he could tell that I didn't feel like talking, so he went back down the bar to where the old men were still talking baseball. I didn't want to think about that cell uptown. I didn't want to think about Miss Emma and the lies I had to tell her. I wanted to think about more pleasant things. I thought about Vivian. Now there was not a more pleasant thing in the world to think about. Today was Friday, wasn't it? And wouldn't it be nice if the two of us could go somewhere and spend the entire weekend? Wouldn't that be nice? I would be able to forget the whole thing, for at least a couple of days. Damn it, it would be so good if we could go away and never come back. I knew I could find a job doing something else, and so could she. If we could just get the hell away from here, just go away. The old men down the bar continued to hit the ball, throw the ball, and slide into bases. And my mind went back to that cell uptown, then to another cell somewhere in Florida. After reading about the execution there, I had dreamed about it over and over and over. As vividly as if I were there, I had seen that cell, heard that boy crying while being dragged to that chair. Please, Joe Lewis, please help. Please help me, help me. And after he had been strapped in the chair, the man who wrote the story could still hear him cry. Mr. Joe Lewis, help me. Mr. Joe Lewis, help me. And down the bar, the old men went on hitting the ball, running the bases, and sliding home. And I wondered if the one in that cell uptown would call on Jackie Robinson, as the other one had called on Joe Lewis. "Taking off, Prof?" Claiborne asked me. "I have to find my lady," I said. "Take it easy, Prof." I waved my hand to the old men. They nodded to me. The school was 3 or 4 blocks away on the main street, but everything back here was pretty close to everything else. The school was on the same street as the Catholic church, the movie theater, the mortuary, a cafe, and the ice cream parlor. The grocery store was not far from the church, but on another street. The barber shop and a gas station weren't too far from the mortuary. Everybody knew everybody. Everybody knew everybody else's business. I parked in front of the movie theater and watched one of the teachers direct the children onto the school bus. When the bus drove away, I got out of my car. "What's happening, handsome?" the teacher said to me. "What's going on, Peggy?" "Thank God it's Friday," she said. "She's still inside." "Having a drink later?" "A couple," Peggy said. As we walked up the entrance to the school, I saw two boys taking in the flag. Peggy told me she would see us at the club later, and I went to Vivian's classroom. The school had only 5 rooms, and in some the classes were doubled. Vivian taught the 6th and 7th grades. The children had all gone, and she sat behind her desk looking over papers. She wore a brown woolen suit and a white blouse. She didn't raise her head until I was near the desk. Then she smiled. She had the most beautiful and most even teeth I had ever seen, but I thought every bit of her was perfect. "What are you doing here?" she asked. "You ever known a Friday I could stay away from you?" I went around the desk and kissed her. "Last boy stood at this desk wouldn't dare do that," she said. "I better not ever catch anyone else doing it," I said. "What are you doing here?" she asked. "To see you. What else?" She looked up at me. She could read my face, and she knew that I had been at the jail. "Still working?" I asked. "Nothing I can't do later." "I saw Peggy. They were going over for a drink." "Sounds like a good idea," Vivian said. She put some papers into a briefcase and stood up. "I have to see the principal before she leaves. Do you know how to clean a blackboard?"
"I've done a few."
"If you do a good job, I'll give you an apple," she said. "Thanks, teacher." She kissed me lightly on the lips and walked away. At the door, she looked back and smiled again. A vertical line had been drawn down the blackboard. On one side of the line were French sentences. On the other side, English translations. They were simple sentences. Where is the book? Where is the tablet? Where is the pencil? I wiped both halves clean, but you could still see the imprint of the sentences. I drew another vertical line, and on one side I wrote, Je t'aime, je t'aime, je t'aime. And on the other side I wrote, I love you, I love you, I love you. Vivian came back into the room and saw what I had done. You naughty boy, she said. Suppose Daisy sees that. Doesn't she already know? I ought to make you stand in the corner on one foot. If you stood there with me, I wouldn't mind. Naughty, naughty boy, she said. Erase that. Only if you kiss me first. She had picked up the briefcase, and I took it from her and laid it on the desk, and I pulled her into my arms. Let's go somewhere, just the two of us, I said, after kissing her. Let's go somewhere and spend the night. Baton Rouge, New Orleans, anywhere. My babies, she said. Dora will look after them. Come on, let's go somewhere. We're having a drink with Peggy, remember? Let's forget Peggy and everybody else. Let's go somewhere. I could see that for a moment she was thinking about it. Then she shook her head. No, she said. I can't take that chance. Don't you want to? More than anything. Then let's take the chance. No, she said. I can't give him an excuse to take my babies. You think he would? I don't know. I can't take that risk. I hate going to Robert and Helen's, then leaving in the middle of the night. I hate it, too, she said. But staying overnight somewhere, I can't take that chance. Where is he now? Last I heard, in Houston. When's he coming back? I don't know. Until he makes up his mind, we just do nothing. I thought we did a lot. You know what I mean. Come on, let's go find Peggy and them and have a drink. Not until I get another kiss. What is the matter? She said, after we had kissed. Maybe it was the way I had held her. Maybe it was the look in my face. I told her what had happened at the jail, how Jefferson had gotten down on his knees to eat the food out of the paper bag. I saw her frown, and she brought her hand up to her mouth. I have to go back to that old woman. But I couldn't go back then. I couldn't face her then. I needed some time to think of a lie to tell her. With her hand still over her mouth, Vivian was looking at me. I wish I could just run away from this place. Vivian shook her head. You know you can't. Why not? For the same reason you haven't done it yet. I've wanted to. But you haven't. Why? You know the answer yourself, Grant. You love them more than you hate this place. Is it love or cowardice? Afraid to take a chance out there. You have your folks in California. You can always go to them. I have thought about it many times. Sure, she said. You even did it once, but you came back. This is all we have, Grant. I want more. I turned away from her and erased the blackboard. Well, let's go have that drink, I said. Wait, Vivian said. She went up to the board and wrote in large letters, Je t'aimerai toujours, je t'aimerai toujours, je t'aimerai toujours. And suppose old Daisy comes in here before you get back on Monday? She already knows about it, Vivian said. So do all the rest, teachers and students.
Chapter 13. Not long after the second bell rang at the church, I heard Miss Eloise Bowie out in the road calling my aunt. I went onto the porch and told her that my aunt was in the back. Miss Eloise, tall and thin, stood in the road leaning on her bamboo walking stick. She wore a long black overcoat and a black hat with a white band. She was looking up the quarter. She said she thought that there was a new chill in the air, and I agreed with her. While she waited for my aunt, she continued to look up the quarter toward the church. I didn't feel like standing out on the porch, but I thought it would be rude to go inside and leave her in the road with no one to talk to. I heard my aunt come into the house from the backyard. She was in her room only a moment before she walked out on the porch. She wore a black coat over a black dress, white stockings, and low-heel black shoes. "Hey there, Lou," she called. "Hey," Miss Eloise called back. She really stretched it out. "Hey! Ain't been waiting too long, I hope," my aunt said. "Just getting here," Miss Eloise said. "Well, you be sure you shut them doors if you leave from here," my aunt said to me. She was already halfway down the steps when she said it. She had not looked at me. Years ago, she had quit looking at me when she was on her way to church. When I came back from the university, I told her that I didn't believe anymore, and I didn't want her to try forcing it on me. If she did, I told her, then I would have to look for some other place to live. She didn't want me to leave, so she let me alone. Only occasionally, when she had some other church member at the house, would she bring it up. Even then, she wouldn't press it too far. She and Miss Eloise started up the corridor, one tall and slim, the other short and much heavier. They stopped in front of Miss Emma's house, and I heard my aunt calling her. "Emma? Hey there, Emma?" Miss Emma came out of the house, and the three of them continued on up to the church together. I went back inside. I had started correcting papers a couple of hours earlier, but I hadn't done very much. On Sunday, my aunt began getting ready for church. As soon as she woke up, which was around 6 o'clock, until 11 o'clock, there was nothing I could do but listen to her singing her termination song. Determination Sunday, the third Sunday of each month, was when members of the church would stand and sing their favorite hymns and tell the congregation where they were determined to spend eternity. My aunt started warming up at 6 in the morning, whether it was Termination Sunday or not, and didn't quit until 11 when she walked out of the house. So I would be forced to put away my work until after she had gone, or I would go for a walk through the corridor and back out into the field. I sat at my table trying to correct papers, but my mind kept drifting back to Friday. It had been dark when I returned to the quarter from Bayonne. It was colder, too. I could see sparks of fires rising out of chimneys. When I stopped in front of Miss Emma's house, Farrell Giroux, who lived across the road, told me that she had gone to my aunt's house. I said goodnight to him and went down the quarter. I recognized Reverend Ambrose's car parked before the door. Now I felt a little guilty for getting back so late. The three of them were in the kitchen drinking coffee. Reverend Ambrose, Miss Emma, and my aunt. They were quiet, sitting in semi-darkness. The only light in the kitchen came from the open door of the stove. No one looked around when I came in, and Reverend Ambrose and Miss Emma barely answered when I spoke their names. My aunt was completely silent. I went to the icebox and took out a pitcher of water, and while I poured a glassful, I looked at the three of them at the table. They were quiet, not even drinking their coffee now. "I'll be in my room," I said to my aunt. "That's all you got to say?" she snapped at me. "I spoke, Tante Lou. You know what I'm talking about." "He was all right," I said. "That's all?" my aunt said. "Or did you forget to go?" "I went, and he was all right," I said. "You got more than that to say, Mr. Man," my aunt said. "Folks been sitting here hours waiting for you." "I see you recover from your cold, Miss Emma. I'm glad it wasn't too—" "Sit down," my aunt said. I went around the table and pulled out the fourth chair. "He was all right," I said. My aunt looked at me. Reverend Ambrose and Miss Emma stared out into the yard. "That's not what she wanted to hear," my aunt said. "How was he when you got there? How was he when you left?" "He was all right both times," I said. "You know what I'm talking about," my aunt said. She looked at me the way an inquisitor must have glared at his poor victims. The only reason she didn't put me on the rack was that she didn't have one. "We both ate some of the food and we talked," I said. All this time, Miss Emma had been gazing into the yard. Now she looked at me. No, toward me. Her thoughts were far distant. "He ate?" "Some," I said. "Y'all talked?" Her mind was still far away. "A little," I said. Now her focus became closer, much closer. She was looking at me now. "What y'all talked about?" "Different things. I told him that you didn't want to come see him because you had a bad cold." She looked at me, waiting to hear his answer. But I couldn't think of another lie, so I shifted to something else. "Then I asked him how he was getting along. He said he was all right. The deputy had already told me he was okay. Guidry was in the office today. He said that Jefferson was getting along fine, didn't cause any trouble. He's using that comb and brush I brought for him, and he was wearing one of my shirts, the khaki one. I think he's doing okay." Miss Emma and my aunt both studied me. Miss Emma wanted to believe what I was saying, but I could see she had doubts. My aunt still wanted to put me on the rack. And Reverend Ambrose continued to look out into the darkness. "What else y'all talked about?" my aunt said. "You left from here for 1:30. "I can't remember everything we talked about," I said. "We just talked. More than 5 hours? You can't remember nothing else?" I was with him about an hour. Then I went back uptown. I have a girl back uptown. I like to see her sometimes. That's maybe where you spent all your time. If you don't think I went to the jail, you can always go up there and ask them. I didn't ask for none of your uppity, mister. I don't mean to be uppity, I told her. I'm just telling you the truth. I spent an hour with him. I had a drumstick and a biscuit, and he had something. I can't remember exactly what it was. Then we talked. Then I left and went back to town, exactly what I did. Deep in you, what you think, Reverend Ambrose suddenly turned from looking out into the darkness. Deep in you. About what, Reverend? Him. What's he thinking? What's he thinking deep in him? Deep in you, what you think. Who knows what somebody else is thinking? They say one thing, they may be thinking about something else. Who can tell? You the teacher, my aunt said not so kindly. Deep in you, Reverend Ambrose said, deep in you. You think he know? He don't grasp the significance of what it's all about? Deep in you. The significance? The gravity. The gravity? Reverend Mose Ambrose was a short, very dark man whose face and bald head were always shining. He was the plantation church's pastor. He was not educated, had not gone to any theological school. He just had heard the voice and started preaching. He was a simple, devoted believer. He christened babies, baptized youths, visited those who were ill, counseled those who had trouble, preached, and buried the dead. All these things could be simply accomplished. But when it came to a discussion with a teacher, though he had known that teacher since his birth, then suddenly things were not so simple. His soul, he said. I don't know anything about the soul, Reverend Ambrose. I baptized him, Reverend Ambrose said. He was 11 or 12 then. But like so many others, he didn't keep the faith either. Like yourself. He stared at me as though I was one of the worst of sinners. Maybe I was. Backsliders were usually worse than those who had never been converted. At least that is what people like him tried to make you believe. Y'all talked about God? He asked me. No, sir. We didn't get around to that. Didn't get around to God? No, sir. He looked at me and nodded his head. If we didn't talk about God, then what else on earth was important enough to talk to someone about who was about to meet God? I figured that's where you came in, Reverend. There's enough room for both of us, I can tell you that. Me, Sister Emma, Sister Lou going up there Monday, he said. Anything I ought to take him? Food, I suppose, maybe some clean clothes. I can't think of anything else. I was thinking more about the Bible, Reverend Ambrose said. That would be nice, too, I said. Reverend Ambrose did not have any more to say. He and my aunt continued to stare at me until I excused myself and left the table. Now, on Sunday, as I sat at the table trying to do my work, I could hear them singing in the church. It seemed that I had listened to this singing and their praying every Sunday of my life. No, I had done more than just listened. I participated until my last year at the university. There was no one thing that changed my faith. I suppose it was a combination of many things, but mostly it was just plain studying. I did not have time for anything else. Many times I would not come home on weekends, and when I did, I found that I cared less and less about the church. Of course, it pained my aunt to see this change in me, and it saddened me to see the pain I was causing her. I thought many times about leaving, as Professor Antoine had advised me to do. My mother and father also told me that if I was not happy in Louisiana, I should come to California. After visiting them the summer following my junior year at the university, I came back, which pleased my aunt. But I have been running in place ever since, unable to accept what used to be my life, but unable to leave it. I pushed away the papers and listened to the singing. Miss Eloise was singing her termination song, "Were You There When They Crucified My Lord?" You could hear that high, shrill voice all over the plantation. I had been hearing it all my life, all my life. After her, there would be someone else and someone else. It would go on for 3 or 4 hours, and it was impossible to do anything but listen to it or leave. I thought I heard a car stop before the door, but I didn't leave the table. Then I thought I heard someone come onto the porch, and when I looked up, I saw her standing at the doorway. I did not believe it was she, because she had never come here before. She wore a blue blazer and a maroon pleated skirt. A black patent leather purse hung from her right shoulder. I hope you don't mind. Only if I'm dreaming. She smiled and came into the room.
Chapter 14. I finished all my work. I wanted to see you, Vivian said. I had already stood up. I moved around the table and kissed her. I couldn't have wished for anything more, but why today? I don't know, she said. I just missed you. I wanted to see you. Where are the children? Dora, she said. I hope I'm not keeping you from anything. Only from a boring afternoon. Vivian smiled and looked around the room. Not much to look at, I said, apologizing for the place. This had been my parents' room before they went to California during the war. There was a bed, a chiffon robe, a washstand, a table, and a couple of chairs. All the furniture was old. On the mantelpiece were three pictures in 5x7 wood frames, one of Vivian and me, one of my mother, and one of my father. A photo collage of Frederick Douglass, Abraham Lincoln, and Booker T. Washington hung over the mantel. Several pictures from calendars over the last few years were tacked to the wall. The wallpaper had a brown, red, and green square, and in places was torn from age. Vivian picked up the picture of my mother. Mom? She said. Yes. Pretty. About your complexion. Very fair. She replaced the picture and took up my father's. Dark and handsome, she said. I suppose you could say that. I don't know these other two, she said, looking at our picture. She looked around the room. I love it. Rustic. It's rustic, all right. Probably the most rustic place you'll ever visit. Pastoral, she said. That too, I said. With the singing and praying up at the church, really pastoral. I like it, she said. Try staying here about a year. She'd gone to the window, and she was looking across the vegetable garden towards the church up the corridor. I moved behind her and put my arms around her waist, and I could smell her perfume. She turned to me, and I brought up my hands to her face and held it a moment while we looked at each other. Then I kissed her very tenderly, and when I looked at her again, I could see in her face that she loved me as much as I loved her. I'm sorry I don't have anything here to drink, I said. Don't worry about that. Would you like to eat something? My aunt made a cake. I had a good breakfast, Vivian said. What about some coffee? Don't bother. I've already made it. Okay. We went through my aunt's room, which was even more rustic than mine, then into the kitchen. In the kitchen was a black four-lid wood stove, a 5-foot-tall white icebox, a handmade table with four wood-bottomed chairs around it, safe with a screen door for the dishes, a broom that had seen better days, an axe in the corner, and several black pots and aluminum pans hanging from nails on the wall. Very, very rustic.
That's all the time we have for today's readings from Ernest Gaines' A Lesson Before Dying. Join us at the same time next week. Thanks again for listening. If you know someone who could benefit from our service, point them in our direction. If you know someone who would like to contribute in any way, point them in our direction. You can call us at 919-832-5138 or visit our website at trianglereadingservice.org. I will repeat both of those at the end of this broadcast. Once again, I'm Kirk Benrood. Our readers, Tom Haynes, Pam Vesper, Robbie Merritt, Awen Fulton, and Dan and Julie Oliver, thank you for listening. The music was supplied by Joni Madden of the Irish-American band Cherish the Ladies. Our phone number once again is 919-832-5138. Our web address once again is triangleReadingService.org.